KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The stock markets have given back all their gains since last November's election. How did President Trump's words and actions affect investors? We ask Morgan Stanley's chief economist on Morning Edition from NPR News. The president of the American Bar Association is sounding a warning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Jaime Martinez, he says calls to impeach judges who ruled against President Trump's policies threaten due process for everyone. Also, we'll hear why Tesla sales are down around the world. And a nurse practitioner at the VA says layoffs and anti-diversity efforts are making it harder to focus on our patients. It's Tuesday, March 11th. Hopefully, singer Bobby McFerrin has no worries today and can just be happy as he turns 75 years old. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in Saudi Arabia today meeting with Ukrainian officials. They're discussing ways to end the war with Russia. This comes after a tense on-camera meeting between President Trump and Ukraine's president more than a week ago in the Oval Office. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports.
Rubio told reporters ahead of his meeting with Ukrainian officials, the most important thing is to leave with a strong sense Ukraine is prepared to do difficult things, like he says the Russians will have to do in order to end the war. Rubio and top White House officials already held an hours-long discussion in Saudi Arabia last month with Russians about the possibility of ending the war. President Trump wants an immediate ceasefire. He's paused military aid to Ukraine and is pushing for U.S. access to the country's critical minerals. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who's not taking part in Rubio's latest meeting, arrived to the city of Jeddah last night, where he met Saudi Arabia's crown prince. He's pushing for U.S. security guarantees. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
A federal judge in New York has ordered the government not to deport a former graduate student at Columbia University. Mahmoud Khalil, a recent graduate, had led protests against the war in Gaza and had urged Columbia University to divest from Israel. NPR's Ryland Barton reports Khalil was sent to a federal detention center in Louisiana after he was arrested over the weekend in New York.
Khalil's attorneys say immigration officers arrested him in the lobby of his apartment. They initially told him that his student visa had been canceled, but he's not on a visa. He's a lawful permanent resident, green card holder. And they eventually told him that his lawful permanent residence had been revoked.
NPR's Ryland Barton reporting. The government alleges Khalil has led activities that support a terrorist group, Hamas, but no evidence has been shown that Khalil has any link to Hamas. Opponents say the Trump administration is silencing viewpoints that it doesn't like. Trump is vowing he'll deport more people. The president's cabinet is now complete. NPR's Don Gagne reports the Senate has confirmed Lori Chavez de Remer as labor secretary.
Chavez de Remer was confirmed with a vote of 67 to 32, with 17 Democrats joining with the majority Republicans to vote yes. Three Republicans did vote no, including Kentucky's two senators, Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul. Senator Paul had expressed doubts about the nominee because of her past support for the PRO Act, also known as the Protect Our Right to Organize Act, which is the labor movement's top legislative priority. During her Senate hearing, Chavez de Remer backed off from that position, saying she saw the PRO Act as a starting point for legislative bargaining. Her nomination was backed by some prominent labor unions, including the Teamsters. Don Gagne, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The House of Representatives will vote on a Republican-backed government spending bill later today. Democratic House leaders oppose it. The GOP's majority in the House is wafer thin, and they can only lose a single vote. Otherwise, the bill will be defeated. Congress only has until Friday to pass a spending bill. Otherwise, the federal government will partially shut down. As marijuana becomes legal in more states, police across the U.S. say they're grappling with how to prevent people from driving under its influence. NPR's Meg Anderson has more.
Studies show THC, the chemical in marijuana that makes you high, can impair driving. But THC can stay in your body for hours or even days, so it's hard to know if someone was high when they got pulled over. Police are searching for a tool that would work as well as the alcohol breathalyzer. They're piloting THC breathalyzers, saliva tests, even goggles to measure a person's pupils. Jordan Wellington, a consultant who works on marijuana policy, says there's also a role for the public to police themselves.
If people wouldn't get on the road when they're impacted and unable to drive a car, we wouldn't be as worried about how to assess them.
Meg Anderson, NPR News.
The British Coast Guard says a fire is still burning on two ships that collided yesterday off Britain's east coast. It's in the North Sea. One of the ships is carrying jet fuel that is leaking through a gash in the side of the oil tanker. The other ship had been carrying toxic chemicals. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantsFoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Ukraine struck Russia today. It was the biggest ever drone attack on Moscow. According to Russian officials, the drone strikes hit a warehouse, killed and injured people, and briefly shut down the airports. It was a sign that Ukraine still has some striking power, even though it has lost some vital American support. Today, U.S. and Ukrainian negotiators meet to discuss that and much more.
This meeting's happening in Saudi Arabia, and the talks do come with some urgency attached to them. The Trump administration is withholding both military aid and intelligence from a country that, up until now, has been a U.S. ally. President Trump has also talked of sanctions against Russia, but unlike with Ukraine, he has yet to announce a penalty.
NPR Ukraine correspondent Joanna Kakissis is covering all this from Kyiv. Hi there, Joanna.
Good morning.
Let's just remember the backdrop here. Ukrainians and Americans met at the White House. Last time they met, it was Volodymyr Zelensky who argued with Trump and Vance, President Trump and Vice President Vance, and they then berated him. So what does Ukraine hope for this time?
Well, Steve, Ukrainians really hope the White House will change its tone after this meeting and its actions, because the past couple of weeks have really unsettled everyone I've spoken to here, including Roman Kostenko. He's a military commander and lawmaker, and he said Ukraine has no choice but to work with the Trump administration because Ukraine will struggle to defend itself without U.S. support.
У нас немає виходу. Боремось, бо помремо.
He's saying we have no way out. We have to manage or we will die. It's not even a choice.
Okay, so they have no choice but to come back to the table. Mm. Here they are. President Trump spoke with reporters over the weekend, and he said of Ukrainians, quote, I want them to want peace, although it is not clear at all what more the president wants than they have offered. So what's on the agenda for this meeting?
Well, Steve, no final decisions are set to be made today. Zelensky's in Saudi Arabia on a state visit, but he said he isn't planning to attend this meeting, and Trump won't be there either. The Ukrainian team includes Zelensky's chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, as well as Ukraine's foreign and defense ministers. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is leading the U.S. delegation. Rubio did say on Monday that he wants Ukraine to show that it's serious about ending the war. He talked about Ukraine making concessions, like giving up land taken by Russia. Now, Ukraine has said repeatedly that it's always been serious about ending this war, and it wants a peace deal with security guarantees so Russia does not rearm and attack again.
Also, just a reminder, at this point, we're only talking about concessions by Ukraine. So what sort of concessions might the Ukrainians be willing to make?
Well, Zelensky has already proposed a partial ceasefire covering aerial attacks in the Black Sea. Not sure if Russia would agree to this, but Rubio seemed to welcome the move. And public opinion polls show between 20 and 30% of Ukrainians would consider giving up occupied territory in return for peace. However, Kostenko told us, look, Ukrainians do not trust Russia to honor any truces. He said Russia also invaded Chechnya and Georgia and violated ceasefires there. The same thing happened to Ukraine after 2014 when Russia first attacked, and 8 years later, Russia launched the full-scale invasion. So Kostenko is saying, I'm a person who has experienced dozens of truces, and all were violated by Russia, so everyone needs to understand that when negotiating this truce.
I guess the Ukrainians want to persuade the Trump administration that a peace deal isn't going to last if it's too easy on Russia. Is that it?
Well, yeah, everyone, every Ukrainian I've spoken to is trying to convince the Trump administration that it's in the U.S.'s interest to support Ukraine. Here's Ivana Klimpush-Tsentsada. She's a member of Ukraine's parliament.
Is it in the interest of the United States to look weak? Because I think Ukrainian defeat would be a direct defeat of the United States. It's not about make America great again. It's about make America weak.
And she said, look, it's not clear this argument will work, but President Trump does not like looking weak.
NPR's Joanna Kakissis, always strong. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The stock market sell-off has prompted broader concerns about the strength of the economy. Market gains since November's election have been lost. And the S&P 500, that's an index of top-performing companies, dropped 9% below last month's all-time high. As consumer sentiment is down and some banks cut growth forecasts, some wonder if the U.S. Might be headed for a recession. U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick on Meet the Press this weekend said this.
Absolutely not. Donald Trump is a winner. He's going to win for the American people. That's just the way it's going to be. There's going to be no recession in America.
For more, I'm joined now by Michael Gapin. He is the chief U.S. economist for Morgan Stanley. So, Michael, there's that saying that I've been hearing the last few days, is that the market is not the economy. But with the tariffs on and off, the stock market fluctuating, and then that drop in consumer spending, what's the likelihood of a recession right now?
Oh, good morning. I do think the likelihood of a recession has risen. You know, pegging it to a particular probability is hard, maybe 20-25%, so maybe twice as high as you might have in any normal given year. So the probability has risen given the combination of policies, tariffs, spending cuts, immigration controls, which all tend to soften activity in the near term. So if you put all of those in place, I think you do have to conclude recession odds have risen. Whether we get one or not is, I think, still open for debate.
Now, your bank, Morgan Stanley, has lowered growth expectations while raising inflation expectations. What does that mean for people?
Well, so the latter in terms of raising inflation, that comes from the tariff story, right? Tariffs are essentially a tax on consumption. You pay more to import that good. So the cost to the consumer ends up rising. So this is not necessarily about services, but mainly about goods and products that we import. So one of the simple tenets of economics is if you make something more expensive, you get less of it. So less trade activity tends to mean growth is a little softer. But you impose tariffs, it tends to push inflation higher in the short run. So that's the balance we're considering.
Now, President Trump has said this is a period of transition and it could lead to a stronger position down the line. Could he be right?
Yes, I think that's essentially the argument the administration is making. The configuration of the global economy, in their opinion, has not been beneficial for America. There's obviously disagreement about that statement. But if you're trying to, in economics, we would say transition to a new equilibrium, it tends to mean there's a disruptive period of transition. And so you would hope the costs you pay in the short run are outweighed by the gains in the long run. But those short run costs tend to be more obvious. The gains over time, we're never quite sure if they materialize. But that is, I think, the argument they're making and why we might see some softness in the near term.
Now, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, the definition of a recession, of a U.S. recession, is, quote, a significant decline in economic activity that is spread across the economy and that lasts more than a few months. Now, Michael, I bring this up only because I remember in the last few years, especially in the Biden administration, there was always this debate. Are we in a recession? Are we not in a recession? So what specific thing could someone point to say, yes, that fits the definition of a recession?
Yeah, so you make a very good point that there's a lot of things that are happening in the economy at any one time. So I think the two most important ones that rise to the top of the scale that say, are we in a recession or not? How long did it last? Is employment growth and personal consumption from households. Employment growth, we added 150,000 jobs last month. Certainly that's slower than prior years, but I would say you need successive months of negative job growth, so outright job declines. Now, we're getting losses at the federal level, but most of our job gains come at the private sector level, so we're still adding jobs. So I would say if the job market turns negative and we're laying off private and public sector workers, that's the key number one criterion. After that, I'd say it's more about spending by households. Personal consumption from households is about 70% of total economic activity in the U.S. And obviously the labor market and what households spend are closely tied together. Okay. So I would look at those two items, unemployment and spending by households.
That's Michael Gapin, chief U.S. economist for Morgan Stanley. Thanks a lot.
Some other news now. Utah is about to become the first state to ban adding fluoride to public drinking water. A bill passed by the Republican-led legislature is awaiting a signature from Governor Spencer Cox. Here's Sean Higgins of our member station KUER in Salt Lake City.
Fluoride has been used as an additive in drinking water for decades and is widely seen as an effective way to prevent cavities, especially in communities without easy access to health care. But state lawmakers here point to a September 2024 case where a federal judge ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to further regulate the amount of fluoride in drinking water. The court cited some research that exposure to fluoride at twice the recommended level can be associated with lower IQs in children. Republican State Representative and bill sponsor Stephanie Grecius told her colleagues in the Utah House of Representatives that this is also an issue of bodily autonomy.
There is also that medical freedom component of we're allowing everyone a choice of what they put into their bodies or not.
Fluoride is naturally occurring in many water systems across the globe. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the American Dental Association recommend water fluoridation. And many dentists agree. Fluoride is the most effective method for preventing tooth decay. That includes Rodney Thornell, who is the president of the Utah Dental Association. He said during testimony in January that lawmakers are taking the EPA ruling too far.
As both a dental professional and concerned citizen, I rise in strong opposition to Bill 81.
In many states, it's up to local governments to decide whether to add fluoride to water. Some Florida communities stopped using it after the state surgeon general recommended against it late last year. In Hawaii, the only places where fluoride is added to drinking water is on military bases, where federal policy mandates it. Fluoride has also come under increased scrutiny thanks to Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He posted on X last November that one of his first acts as an administration official would be to remove the mineral from public water. He hasn't issued any directives on that yet. Under Utah's ban, anyone who wants to obtain additional fluoride can still do so at a pharmacy or dental office. Utah's Republican Governor, Spencer Cox, says he plans to sign the bill. For NPR News in Salt Lake City, I'm Sean Higgins.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times editor David Enrich joins us to discuss his new book, Murder the Truth. It chronicles a campaign by billionaires, politicians, and corporations to silence journalists and undermine free speech protections. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from EasyCater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Elon Musk's fan base has helped his car company Tesla succeed, but Tesla's sales and share price have been falling fast, and Musk may be part of the reason why. Here's Villa Marx.
A protest took place last week at a Tesla dealership in New York as anger against Elon Musk and his role at the Department of Government Efficiency was transferred to Tesla. In Massachusetts, a Tesla charging station became the target for an arson attack. While in southwest France, a group calling itself anti-fascist torched a dozen Tesla vehicles. In Europe, sales of Teslas in January fell 47% compared to last year, and that's at a time when electric vehicle numbers from other manufacturers are rising, says Sigrid De Vries, Director General of the European Association of Automakers that tracks new car sales across the continent.
We see an upward trend. I mean, by any standard, you could say that reaching 15% market share, again, it's an average, for battery electric vehicles is remarkable in just 5 years.
But Tesla sales are struggling not only in Europe, but China, Australia, and the US too, says Gordon Johnson of New York-based equity research firm GLJ. And the reasons for that are twofold, he says.
It's a combination of competition eating Tesla's lunch with similar or better range, as well as disgust with Elon Musk, his unwielding support for Donald Trump. And many of Tesla's historical customers have been, you know, far left-leaning liberals. That's turned a lot of people off.
Johnson's been covering Tesla since 2019 and says vehicles are being vandalized, set on fire, or painted with swastikas because of Musk's decision to serve in the new U.S. administration.
If you talk to any normal auto CEO, they'll tell you they stay out of politics and they try to stay out of the limelight. Because when you create brand destruction for an automobile company, it's nearly impossible to come back from that. And Elon Musk is creating brand destruction on a grand scale.
Other auto analysts, though, insist Tesla's situation is slightly more complicated.
There's an extreme conflation of some of the concern around consumer souring on Elon with a major changeover, one of the largest ever done in the auto industry.
John Murphy is head of automotive U.S. research at Bank of America and says the lack of updated Tesla models may be a more relevant reason for the company's sales slumps.
The key driving factor at Tesla is it's going through a major changeover of its all-important Model Y. That will result in shortages, and we'd expect sales to recover pretty meaningfully in the second and third quarter as that production ramps back up.
When you compare company revenues, Tesla shares have for a long time traded far higher than those of other U.S. car makers. So some analysts say that means its stock has further to fall. More than many other stocks, Tesla shares are also traded by ordinary retail investors, some of whom love the company, some of whom hate it. That can make the stock price rise and fall sharply, analysts say, and that volatility in turn encourages hedge funds to join the trading and profit from the price swings. With the recent slump in Tesla's share price, Musk has seen a dent in his personal fortunes that's larger than the net worth of fellow billionaire Bill Gates. For NPR News, I'm Bill Marks in London.
The Department of Veterans Affairs says it plans to cut 80,000 more jobs out of a workforce of several hundred thousand. That's one of many administration moves against the workforce that was hired to look after veterans. In speeches before the election, President Trump's budget director said his goal was to put federal employees, quote, in trauma. NPR's Katie Riddle reports on the new rules, small and large, that affect one VA employee as she tries to provide mental health care.
Since the Trump White House issued an executive order to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, therapists at the VA can no longer have pride flags in their offices.
We're kind of skirting around that. Some people have put up art in their office that says, like, love is love, and it'll be a rainbow.
This woman is a mental health practitioner at a VA facility. She asked us not to disclose exactly where she works and to identify her only as Lynn, her middle name. She fears she could be fired for speaking out. She and some of her colleagues have started wearing rainbow jewelry and clothing, sending a message to her queer patients, you are safe here.
So we're all kind of, like, being subversive.
Her defiance comes with a cost.
Feeling like, if I wear this stuff, am I then going to become a target from either my patients, but also maybe my peers, because there's this culture of you need to rat on people.
She's received emails encouraging people to report colleagues who are violating the new ban on DEI. All this stress and anxiety, she says, demands a lot of mental energy, energy that gets robbed from her patients.
I've been really struggling with my concentration and my ability to focus when I'm at work because, again, I feel like I have this axe over my head all the time.
She says the news around federal cuts is destabilizing to her patients as well. For those that have post-traumatic stress disorder, it's especially difficult.
That sense of insecurity and lack of control is really triggering for PTSD. And then there's a sense of betrayal from the government.
The VA is one of the biggest providers of mental health care in the country. The positions that have already been cut have not primarily been clinicians, like doctors and nurses, but some warn the disruption to care will get worse regardless. Rashi Romanoff is the CEO of a nonprofit known as NAVREF, which stands for the National Association of Veterans Research and Education Foundations. The organization helps facilitate research projects at the VA.
The challenge is that, you know, healthcare and the delivery of healthcare really requires these broad, diverse teams of individuals.
Romanoff says the VA has been a leader in not just providing mental health care, but also innovating in it.
We're really focused on the ability to conduct high-quality research because having high-quality research is a part of high-quality care.
In addition to the firings, the VA indicated it would not renew research positions and then reversed course and took a 90-day pause to review the research contracts. NAVREF warns that if these positions are lost, clinical trials studying opioid dependency or suicide prevention could end. They estimate $35 million of research is in jeopardy.
Between 350 and 400 clinical trials, which would have to be stopped or interrupted or halted or canceled because of this staffing shortage.
In an email response to NPR, the VA underscored that no contract positions will be terminated in the next 90 days, quote, while the department conducts a comprehensive assessment of ongoing research, unquote. Nurse practitioner Lynn says going to work every day feels like she's working on the Titanic.
And half the people on the boat are still in the ballroom partying, and 25% of them are actively telling me I'm hysterical.
Every day of providing mental health care requires its own mental battle.
And another portion of them are actively putting more holes in the boat at the same time.
She plans to stay aboard until she has no choice but to save herself. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The COVID-19 virus today is not exactly the same one that began the pandemic 5 years ago.
I thought it would undergo some evolution, but the speed at which it's undergone that evolution and the ability it's shown to undergo these big evolutionary jumps is really remarkable.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A look at how COVID and our immunity to it has changed on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly.
Talks between the U.S. and Ukraine to end Russia's war with Kyiv began several hours ago in Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is leading the American delegation at the discussions in Jeddah along the Red Sea. The talks are expected to focus largely on terms of a potential ceasefire between Kyiv and Moscow. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley spoke to some Ukrainians in Lviv who say they want long-lasting peace.
Restaurant waiter Stepan Yanu says Ukraine has nearly always lived under Russian threat, except for the 23 years from its independence in 1991 when the Soviet Union broke up to 2014 when Russia took Crimea and invaded the Donbass.
Ukrainians need peace. Minimal, this is 50 years, I think.
To be able to raise its children and build democracy without ironclad guarantees, Yanu says Russia will invade again.
Europe, USA, must understand, if in Ukraine we don't have peace, this repeat history, yeah?
He says Ukraine must not be forced to capitulate. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Lviv.
Former Democratic Congresswoman Katie Porter is the latest candidate to announce a run for governor of California in 2026. Governor Gavin Newsom is barred from running again because of term limits. This is NPR News from Washington. Stocks on Wall Street opened lower moments ago following yesterday's sharp sell-off. Concerns about inflation, tariffs, and declining consumer confidence weighed on investors yesterday, as did President Trump's comments to Fox Business, where he did not rule out the possibility of a recession this year. It was 5 years ago that the coronavirus pandemic began. COVID-19 is blamed for more than a million deaths in the U.S. and millions more worldwide. As NPR's Amy Held reports, the virus continues to reshape how people live.
Life changed March 11, 2020. The World Health Organization declared a global pandemic as the then novel virus hit 114 countries. 2 days later, the Trump administration would declare a nationwide emergency. Travel, school, work, socializing shut down. 5 years on, the legacy is still shifting global economies, reshaping how we work and how we shop. And the virus is still here, with hundreds of deaths every week in the U.S. and millions of people living with long COVID. Now, the second Trump administration has withdrawn the U.S. from the WHO and is slashing federal health agencies. As other infectious diseases spread, bird flu and measles in the U.S., Mpox and Ebola overseas. Amy Held, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 83 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. President Trump has made no secret of his efforts to punish law firms that have represented his perceived enemies. On Thursday, he signed an executive order banning the government from hiring a law firm that represented Hillary Clinton's campaign in the 2016 presidential race, and he signed another order forcing federal agencies to cut ties with the firm that represented special counsel Jack Smith. The American Bar Association sets ethical standards for lawyers, and leaders there say that the administration is attempting to tip the scales of justice. William R. Bay serves as the ABA's president. He joins us now. So, Bill, in addition to the executive orders I just mentioned, can you walk us through what other actions this administration has taken that you think infringe on the impartiality of the courts?
You know, we're really trying to highlight the pattern of words and actions that should concern every American. And I think the incidents you cite, plus some others, really evidence a troubling pattern of actions from the highest level of our government. And really three things. High-ranking government officials, not just appointed, but elected as well, threaten to impeach judges when a decision doesn't go the government's way. Lawyers or law firms are being targeted for suing the government or representing someone the government does not like. I mean, things you just talked about. And third is the Justice Department lawyers are being punished for simply doing their job. These words and actions interfere with fair and impartial courts, the right to counsel of your choice. It's due process. It's the freedom of speech, for God's sakes.
So you think this is a unique moment in history? Because I can't imagine that through history that presidents have liked it too much if a court doesn't let them do what they want to do.
I think the thing that differentiates this is the intensity and the frequency. And really, we don't stand alone in insisting this must stop. I mean, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court just wrote about efforts to intimidate judges. I mean, he really decried the efforts of an elected official who was calling for the impeachment of a judge for the decision in a high-profile case. Just what's happened here.
Now, your memo alludes to messages that Elon Musk has posted on X, although you don't identify him by name. Musk has repeatedly called to impeach judges who delay or block aspects of Donald Trump's agenda. But officially, he's a special government employee, and it's not really clear what authority he has in the executive branch. Bill, why does it matter then if he attacks judges online?
It's not the people that it's important. It's the pattern, and it's the number and the frequency. I mean, he is a high-ranking government official. He has a role. It's just simply not right. And I think Americans know it's not right. They know you can't tilt justice one way or the other by saying, oh, you know, I don't like the judge that ruled this way, so we'll get rid of him. That's so fundamentally wrong.
Can you give us a sense of how all of this affects people outside of the legal profession?
I think the answer is not complicated. The behavior undermines the rules and the laws that keep everyone in our country safe and secure. They're basic rules of fairness, rules that are supposed to apply to everyone, including the government. Nobody is above the law. Lawyers know, and most Americans know, that it's important to follow court rulings and the law. I don't agree with every court decision, but if you disagree with the ruling, you appeal it.
Bill, earlier you mentioned that the American Bar Association is nonpartisan. Republicans, though, have long said that the ABA has become too left-wing. So how do you respond to claims that the ABA is partisan or has become partisan?
The issue of unfair attacks on judges is something we have talked about often. ABA presidents have issued 15 separate statements dealing with judicial independence, security, and the integrity of the justice system in the U.S. in the past 8 years. That's Democratic and Republican administrations. And it's not who we're opposed to, it's what we're in support of. I believe today is the day to do the right thing. If we want America to be great, we must do the right thing every day. And that's why we support the rule of law, the bedrock principles of our democracy, and that's what we're speaking. Once again, for the rule of law, because there's a clear pattern we see that would suggest it is under considerable duress.
William R. Bay is the president of the American Bar Association. William, thank you.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed talking with you.
Authorities in the Philippines arrested former President Rodrigo Duterte today. The International Criminal Court has accused Duterte of crimes against humanity for orchestrating killings while he was president. Killings that he characterized as a war on drugs. The anti-drug campaign began in 2016 and continues to this day, even after Duterte left office in 2022, and critics say it has resulted in tens of thousands of extrajudicial killings. Michael Sullivan reports.
Rumors of an arrest warrant issued by Interpol had been circulating over the weekend as Duterte was in Hong Kong addressing overseas Filipino workers. Duterte dismissed the rumors in his usual foul-mouthed, contemptuous fashion and dared law enforcement to go ahead. But when it actually happened this morning on his return to Manila, many were shocked.
With all the things that are happening in the world and with all of the stuff that's on the table of the ICC, people were really not sure whether this is something that would come down, but it did.
Carlos Conde is the Manila-based researcher for Human Rights Watch.
You know, a lot of Filipinos, particularly the families of victims, are, as you can imagine, ecstatic over this because, you know, at least the first step has been taken.
In the beginning, Duterte's drug war was wildly popular. It was even one of the central planks of his presidential election campaign. But as the death toll mounted, so did people's unease. But many, Conde says, were too frightened to say anything.
During Mr. Duterte's time, they were so afraid. They were, you know, there was a culture of fear, the reign of fear, of terror. That is no longer the case. So you see now more and more people being vocal about their position on the violence before and being more vocal about wanting to see the Duterte's answer for all the crimes that they did during their time.
According to a copy of the warrant seen by the Associated Press, there are reasonable grounds to believe that attacks on victims were both widespread and systematic, and that thousands appear to have been killed in these extrajudicial killings. Human rights groups say the number could be in the tens of thousands. Fewer than a dozen police officers have been convicted in connection with the deaths. But activists are hoping Duterte's arrest might change that. It's not clear when the ailing 79-year-old will be handed over to the ICC. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai, Thailand.
This afternoon at All Things Considered, we've had so many stories about how tariffs could affect the economy. What would they do to the price of craft beer, which you might need if the stock market keeps going down, but that's another story. Listen on the radio, on the NPR app, or ask your smart speaker for your local station by name. This is NPR News.
Senior U.S. officials meet with Ukrainian President Zelensky. We'll look at how European countries are stepping up support for Ukraine. Next time, Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, me Martinez. We told you last month about a mission to the moon to find water. Also on board was a song by Imagine Dragons, a theme song to the sci-fi video game Starfield. The goal was to beam the song back to Earth, which would be a first, but the lander missed its target last week and tipped over. Song is still up there, though, along with tracks from Jimi Hendrix, Bob Marley, and Elvis. Pretty good playlist if other living beings want to drop by to listen. Or Alien Dance Party. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm E. Martinez. What do Mudeng, the pygmy hippo, Haley Welch, a.k.a. the Hawk to a Girl, and First Lady Melania Trump all have in common? Well, they inspired highly valuable, highly volatile types of cryptocurrency over the past year, meme coins. So how should we think about this current moment in the crypto markets? Here's Alexi Horowitz-Ghazi from our Planet Money podcast.
It's generally accepted that the first meme coin was launched back in 2013 by an Australian tech worker named Jackson Palmer. We talked to him in 2018 about how he came up with the idea for Dogecoin.
I had one browser tab open with this article about Doge, and right next to it I had CoinMarketCap, so my tab names kind of almost spelt it out for me.
Doge, you may remember, was a popular meme featuring a quizzical Shiba Inu paired with grammatically challenged captions like, "Such wow."
And I just thought, Dogecoin, that's hilarious.
Doge was supposed to be a joke about how absurdly speculative crypto was becoming. But instead of rethinking their investments, the good people of the crypto world leaned in. The value of Dogecoin took off, and a bunch of other meme coins followed. For a while, the number of new coins was limited because creating a new one required some technical expertise. But recently, that has changed because of a platform called Pump.Fun. Launched in early 2024 by a group of London-based entrepreneurs, Pump.Fun is a way to allow basically anyone to create their own crypto. We reached out to them, but they didn't get back to us. Over the past year, more than 5 million new meme coins have been listed on the platform, by everyone from literal children to C-list celebrities to presidents. As Bloomberg investigative reporter Zeke Fox explains, not all of these meme coin launches are successful.
Something like 99% of coins are dead on arrival.
Which means they basically have zero buyers.
Right. Like, I bet you a lot of them never sell a single token.
He says some fortunes are made on meme coins, but he's also seen countless pump and dump schemes and enormous losses for investors, not unlike a casino. It's essentially a new form of gambling where the coin's creators are at a huge advantage.
By the time that you or I hear about any coin, you know, the insiders have probably accumulated a big supply at a low price, and they're just waiting for losers like us to hear about it and buy some so that they can sell theirs and get real money.
Zeke says some traders have made millions of dollars off of meme coins, which has helped fuel the frenzy over new ones. But Dune Analytics found that just 3% of traders have ever made more than $1,000. And keep in mind, meme coin trading is a zero-sum game. Every dollar someone makes on a meme coin mathematically has to come at the expense of someone else buying it. Which means that this tiny minority of winners, that 3% of traders, they're making their fortunes off the vast majority of meme coin investors.
Now, I think that most of the people who buy this, like, they're not being fooled by the coins. They just think that, hey, I am not the last person who's going to buy this coin. Someone else will come along later and buy this coin for more.
Has anyone made a greater fool coin?
I guarantee that they have.
And when we checked the Pump.Fun registry, there turned out to be no less than 12 competing greater fool meme coins, half of them with the ticker sign FOOL. Alexi Horowitz-Ghazi, NPR News.
Planet Money and the Indicator podcast have been doing a mini-series on meme coins. You can catch up in any podcast app.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Staffing changes at the Pentagon include at least two moves that affect what troops can or cannot do in combat. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth fired some of the Pentagon's Judge Advocates General, or JAGs. They're the lawyers who keep the military in check and operating within the laws of armed conflict. Hegseth is also cutting positions and offices at the Pentagon that are focused on reducing harm to civilians during combat operations. Retired Army General Joseph Votel has a different view of those jobs.
I've seen the heartbreaking impact of where things have gone wrong. If you cause so many civilian casualties and you cause so much civilian harm here, it can actually undermine the mission that the military has been sent in to do.
Votel served as head of the U.S. Central Command during President Trump's first term. Leila Fadel spoke with him about why two Pentagon groups were created, the Civilian Harm Mitigation and Response Office and the Civilian Protection Center.
These particular offices were initiated during the first Trump administration, particularly during our campaign against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, where we were confronting on a day-to-day basis ISIS fighters who were intermingled and frequently used the civilian population as shields as we were going through this. So it was a significant challenge that we were having operationally.
I worked in Iraq for a long time, and I saw the damage done to the war of hearts and minds when a civilian was killed. I mean, what is the importance when it comes to combat operations to make sure you're protecting civilian life when a war is going on?
Well, I think the most important aspect is that these efforts, I think, can help us actually add precision to our military lethality. The new administration has talked a lot about this, and I certainly agree with that. You know, you don't necessarily have to kill civilians to cause harm against civilians. Removing important infrastructure and other aspects like that certainly can have an impact.
But on the basic level, doesn't it matter that the U.S. military is seen as a military that protects civilian life, even when you're fighting an enemy?
Certainly it does. I mean, you know, the law of armed conflict is a foundational underpinning to, you know, the training of our officer and non-commissioned officer leaders. And we recognize we have a responsibility to protect innocents and to conduct our operations in accordance with the international norms, standards, and laws. And I think that this effort that is focused on civilian harm mitigation, I think it helps enhance that. I don't think this is designed to be more constricting on commanders. I think it's really designed to be more informative in helping us be a better educated and smarter force.
When you heard these positions at offices were being cut, what was your first reaction?
Obviously, this is an area that I've paid some attention to, largely because of my own experience. So,
yeah, I mean, you were among the first troops into Afghanistan in 2001, and you've commanded troops there and in Iraq.
Right. So I've dealt with this problem quite often as a CENTCOM commander. This was a daily challenge for us in places like Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. So it isn't something that you take lightly. So again, these are difficult decisions that the department is making about where they put their resources. I don't want to minimize that. But in my view, I think the benefit to be gained by supporting these positions, I think it outweighs the movement of resources to other places.
If you could just say a little bit more about why it's a net benefit. I mean, when you think about resources and allocating resources to this, how important is it to the stated mission?
Yeah, I think there's three big areas where this can really help. One is in this human shielding aspect that we've talked about. Related to that is understanding the information environment around that and how you can reduce the disinformation and the misuse of information. The new administration, I think, correctly has embraced things like artificial intelligence and reaching out to advanced technologies. These are capabilities that can actually help in this particular area. I think we've seen some examples of that with the Israelis trying to use artificial intelligence to try to be more precise in the things that they are doing and did.
But it's a very flawed, I mean, there's been a lot of criticism, too, that there's a targeting system that ends up possibly getting people caught in the mix that aren't actually Hamas.
And that's always a possibility in these operations. And I'm the first to tell you, as somebody who did this, is that we did make mistakes. It's not clean. It's going to be difficult. But it shouldn't diminish our desire to try to mitigate that as much as we possibly can.
Retired U.S. Army General Joseph Votel, he served as head of U.S. Central Command. Thank you so much for your time and your insights.
Okay, thank you.
The removal of Washington, D.C.'s Black Lives Matter street mural is underway. The city created the mural in front of Lafayette Square in 2020 amid a nationwide wave of protests after police murdered George Floyd. Here's Sarah Y. Kim from member station WAMU.
On Monday morning, a few residents and visitors stopped to say goodbye to Black Lives Matter Plaza, a two-block mural composed of large yellow letters. They watched construction workers remove bollards from the street. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser named the plaza and commissioned the mural shortly after federal officers tear gassed people in Lafayette Square, peacefully protesting police brutality. It was seen as an act of defiance against President Donald Trump, but now the mayor is overseeing its destruction. D.C. native Karen George says she's upset, but there isn't much Bowser can do. The city has to remove the mural or risk losing federal funds.
It's a rock and a hard place for her. We're not a state, we're a district.
Her sister, Adrienne Lind, says she thought the mural would be permanent, a symbol of her city and a tourist attraction like the Washington Monument. She says it's painful to see it go, but that it won't be forgotten.
There's no such thing as erasure. If that's the attempt, it's just not possible to do, because it's not just that we saw it, the whole world saw it.
Lind and George say they'd like to see it preserved in a museum or recreated elsewhere in the city. Dr. Reed Tuckson, former health commissioner for the city, says this is an all too familiar situation where outsiders exert power over the people of D.C.
Once again, we see the Congress treating this city as if we were not adults who could govern their own affairs.
Under a bill introduced last week in Congress, the street is expected to be redesignated as Liberty Plaza. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Y. Kim in Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Mm-hmm.